just see them as men, and on the whole, rather like them for it.
Oh, to do with women's liberation, is it?
No, not at all, Claire said. I saw just the same kinds of behaviour between men and women in 1743 that you see now. Some differences, of course, in how they each behave, but not so much in how they behave to each other.
She looked out over the dark waters of the loch, shading her eyes with her hand. She might have been keeping an eye out for otters and floating logs, but Roger thought that far-seeing gaze was looking a bit farther than the cliffs of the opposite shore.
"You like men, don't you?" he said quietly. "Tall men."
She smiled briefly, not looking at him.
"One," she said softly.
"Will you go, then, if I can find him?"
He rested his oars momentarily, watching her. She drew a deep breath before answering. The wind flushed her cheeks with pink and moulded the fabric of the white shirt to her figure, showing off a high bosom and a slender waist.
"Too young to be a widow," he thought. "Too lovely to be wasted."
"I don't know," she said a little shakily. "The thought of it, or rather the thoughts of it. On the one hand, to find Jamie, and then on the other, to go through again." A shudder went through her, closing her eyes. "It's indescribable, you know," she said, eyes still closed, as though she saw inside them the ring of stones on Craigner Dun. "Horrible, but horrible in a way that isn't like other horrible things, so you can't say." She opened her eyes and smiled wryly at him.
"A bit like trying to tell a man what having a baby is like. He can more or less grasp the idea that it's painful, but he isn't equipped actually to understand what it feels like."
Roger grunted with amusement.
"Oh, aye. Well, there's some difference, you know. I've actually heard those bloody stones."
He shivered himself involuntarily. The memory of the night 3 months ago when Gillian Edgars had gone through the stones wasn't one he willingly called to mind. It had come back to him in nightmares several times, though. He heaved strongly on the oars, trying to erase it.
"Like being torn apart, isn't it?"
he said, his eyes intent on hers.
"There's something pulling at you, ripping, dragging, and not just outside. Inside you as well, so you feel your skull will fly to pieces any moment. And the filthy noise."
He shuddered again. Claire's face had gone slightly pale.
"I didn't know you could hear them," she said. "You didn't tell me."
"It didn't seem important."
He studied her a moment as he pulled, then added quietly,
"Bree heard them as well."
"I see."
She turned to look back over the loch, where the wake of the tiny boat spread its V-shaped wings. Far behind, the waves from the passage of a larger boat reflected back from the cliffs and joined again in the centre of the loch, making a long, humped form of glistening water, a standing wave, a phenomenon of the loch that had often been mistaken for a sighting of the monster.
"It's there, you know,"
she said suddenly, nodding down into the black, peat-laden water. He opened his mouth to ask what she meant, but then realised that he did know. He had lived near Loch Ness for most of his life, fished for eels and salmon in its waters, and heard, and laughed at, every story of the fearsome beastie that had ever been told in the pubs of Drumna Drochet and Fort Augustus. Perhaps it was the unlikeliness of the situation, sitting here, calmly discussing whether the woman with him should or should not take the unimaginable risk of catapulting herself into an unknown past. Whatever the cause of his certainty, it seemed suddenly not only possible, but sure, that the dark water of the loch hid unknown but fleshly mystery.
"What do you think it is?" he asked,
as much to give his disturbed feelings time to settle as out of curiosity. Claire leaned over the side, watching intently as a log drifted into view.
The one I saw was probably a plesiosaur, she said at last. She didn't look at Roger, but kept her gaze astern, though I didn't take notes at the time. Her mouth twisted in something not quite a smile. How many stone circles are there? She asked abruptly. In Britain, in Europe. Do you know?
Not exactly.
Several hundred, though, he answered cautiously. Do you think they're all... How should I know? She interrupted impatiently. The point is, they may be. They were set up to mark something, which means there may be the hell of a lot of places where that something has happened. She tilted her head to one side, wiping the wind-blown hair out of her face, and gave him a lopsided smile. That would explain it, you know.
Explain what?
Roger felt fogged by the rapid shifts of her conversation.
The monster!
She gestured out over the water.
What if there's another of those places, under the loch?
A time corridor, passage, whatever.
Roger looked out over the purling wake, staggered by the idea.
It would explain a lot.
There was a smile hiding at the corner of her mouth, behind the veil of blowing hair. He couldn't tell whether she was serious or not.
The best candidates for monster are all things that have been extinct for hundreds of thousands of years. If there's a time passage under the loch, that would take care of that little problem.
It would also explain why the reports are sometimes different,
Roger said, becoming intrigued by the idea.
If it's different creatures who come through.
And it would explain why the creature or creatures haven't been caught and aren't seen all that often. Maybe they go back the other way too, so they aren't in the loch all the time.
What a marvellous idea, Roger said.
He and Claire grinned at each other.
You know what? She said.
I'll bet that isn't going to make it on the list of popular theories.
Roger laughed, catching a crab, and droplets of water sprayed over Brianna. She snorted, sat up abruptly, blinking, then sank back down, face flushed with sleep, and was breathing heavily within seconds.
She was up late last night, helping me box up the last set of records to go back to the University of Leeds,
Roger said, defensive on her behalf. Claire nodded abstractedly, watching her daughter.
Jamie could do that, she said softly. Lie down and sleep anywhere.
She fell silent. Roger rode steadily on, toward the point of the loch where the grim bulk of the ruins of Castle Urquhart stood amid its pines.
The thing is, Claire said at last, it gets harder.
Going through the first time was the most terrible thing I'd ever had happen to me. Coming back was a thousand times worse. Her eyes were fixed on the looming castle. I don't know whether it was because I didn't come back on the right day. It was Beltane when I went, and 2 weeks before when I came back.
Gillian,
she went on Beltane too. In spite of the heat of the day, Roger felt slightly cold, seeing again the figure of the woman who had been both his ancestor and his contemporary, standing in the light of a blazing bonfire, fixed for a moment in the light, before disappearing forever into the cleft of the standing stones. That's what her notebook said, that the door is open on the sun feasts and the fire feasts. Perhaps it's only partly open as you near those times. Or perhaps she was wrong altogether. After all, she thought you had to have a human sacrifice to make it work. Claire swallowed heavily. The petrol-soaked remains of Greg Edgars, Gillian's husband, had been recovered from the stone circle by the police on May Day. The record concluded of his wife only, fled, whereabouts unknown. Claire leaned over the side, trailing a hand in the water. A small cloud drifted over the sun, turning the loch a sudden grey, with dozens of small waves rising on the surface as the light wind increased. Directly below, in the wake of the boat, the water was darkly impenetrable. 700 feet deep is Loch Ness, and bitter cold. What can live in a place like that? "Would you go down there, Roger?" she asked softly.
"Jump overboard, dive in,
go on down through that dark until your lungs were bursting, not knowing whether there are things with teeth and great heavy bodies waiting."
Roger felt the hair on his arms rise, and not only because the sudden wind was chilly.
"But that's not all the question," she continued, still staring into the blank, mysterious water. "Would you go if Brianna were down there?"
She straightened up and turned to face him.
"Would you go?"
The amber eyes were intent on his, unblinking as a hawk's. He licked his lips, chapped and dried by the wind, and cast a quick look over his shoulder at Brianna sleeping. He turned back to face Claire.
"Yes, I think I would."
She looked at him for a long moment, and then nodded, unsmiling.
"So would I."
Part 5. You can't go home again. Chapter 18. Roots. September 1968.
"The woman next to me probably weighed 300 pounds. She wheezed in her sleep, lungs labouring to lift the burden of her massive bosom for the 200,000th time. Her hip and thigh and pudgy arm pressed against mine, unpleasantly warm and damp. There was no escape. I was pinned on the other side by the steel curve of the plane's fuselage. I eased one arm upward and flicked on the overhead light in order to see my watch. 10:30 by London time. At least another 6 hours before the landing in New York promised escape. The plane was filled with the collective sighs and snorts of passengers dozing as best they might. Sleep for me was out of the question. With a sigh of resignation, I dug into the pocket in front of me for the half-finished romance novel I had stashed there. The tale was by one of my favourite authors, but I found my attention slipping from the book, either back to Roger and Brianna, whom I had left in Edinburgh, there to continue the hunt, or forward to what awaited me in Boston. I wasn't sure just what did await me, which was part of the problem. I had been obliged to come back, if only temporarily. I had long since exhausted my vacation, plus several extensions. There were matters to be dealt with at the hospital, bills to be collected and paid at home, the maintenance of the house and yard to be attended to. I shuddered to think what heights the lawn in the backyard must have attained by now. Friends to be called on. One friend in particular. Joseph Abernathy had been my closest friend from medical school on. Before I made any final, and likely irrevocable, decisions, I wanted to talk to him. I closed the book in my lap and sat tracing the extravagant loops of the title with one finger, smiling a little. Among other things, I owed a taste for romance novels to Joe. I had known Joe since the beginning of my medical training. He stood out among the other interns at Boston General just as I did. I was the only woman among the budding doctors. Joe was the only black intern. Our shared singularity gave us each a special awareness for the other. Both of us sensed it clearly, though neither mentioned it. We worked together very well, but both of us were wary, for good reason, of exposing ourselves, and the tenuous bond between us, much too nebulous to be called friendship, remained unacknowledged until near the end of our internship. I had done my first unassisted surgery that day, an uncomplicated appendectomy, done on a teenaged boy in good health. It had gone well, and there was no reason to think there would be post-operative complications. Still, I felt an odd kind of possessiveness about the boy, and didn't want to go home until he was awake and out of recovery, even though my shift had ended. I changed clothes and went to the doctor's lounge on the third floor to wait. The lounge wasn't empty. Joseph Abernathy sat in one of the rump-sprung stuffed chairs, apparently absorbed in a copy of US News and World Report. He looked up as I entered and nodded briefly to me before returning to his reading. The lounge was equipped with stacks of magazines, salvaged from the waiting rooms,
and a number of tattered paperbacks abandoned by departing patients. Seeking distraction, I thumbed past a six-month-old copy of Studies in Gastroenterology, a ragged copy of Time magazine, and a neat stack of Watchtower tracts. Finally picking up one of the books, I sat down with it. It had no cover, but the title page read, The Impetuous Pirate, a sensuous, compelling love story boundless as the Spanish Main, said the line beneath the title. The Spanish Main, eh? If escape was what I wanted, I couldn't do much better, I thought, and opened the book at random. It fell open automatically to page 42. Tipping up her nose scornfully, Tessa tossed her lush blonde tresses back, oblivious to the fact that this caused her voluptuous breasts to become even more prominent in the low-necked dress. Valdez's eyes widened at the sight, but he gave no outward sign of the effect such wanton beauty had on him.
"I thought we might become better acquainted, señorita," he suggested, in a low, sultry voice that made little shivers of anticipation run up and down Tessa's back.
"I have no interest in becoming acquainted with a filthy, despicable, underhanded pirate," she said. Valdez's teeth gleamed as he smiled at her, his hand stroking the handle of the dagger at his belt. He was impressed at her fearlessness, so bold, so impetuous, and so beautiful. I raised an eyebrow, but went on reading, fascinated. With an air of imperious possession, Valdez swooped an arm about Tessa's waist.
"You forget, señorita," he murmured,
the words tickling her sensitive earlobe.
"You are a prize of war, and the captain of a pirate ship has first choice of the booty."
Tessa struggled in his powerful arms as he bore her to the berth and tossed her lightly onto the jeweled coverlet. She struggled to catch her breath, watching in terror as he undressed, laying aside his azure-blue velvet coat and then the fine ruffled white linen shirt. His chest was magnificent, a smooth expanse of gleaming bronze. Her fingertips ached to touch it, even though her heart pounded deafeningly in her ears as he reached for the waistband of his breeches.
"But no," he said, pausing. "It is unfair of me to neglect you, señorita. Allow me."
With an irresistible smile, he bent and gently cupped Tessa's breasts in the heated palms of his calloused hands, enjoying the voluptuous weight of them through the thin silken fabric. With a small scream, Tessa shrank away from his probing touch, pressing back against the lace-embroidered feather pillow.
"You resist? What a pity to spoil such fine clothing, señorita."
He took a firm grasp on her jade-silk bodice and yanked, causing Tessa's fine white breasts to leap out of their concealment like a pair of plump partridges taking wing. I made a sound, causing Dr. Abernethy to look sharply over the top of his U.S. News and World Report. Hastily rearranging my face into a semblance of dignified absorption, I turned the page. Valdez's thick black curls swept her chest as he fastened his hot lips on Tessa's rose-pink nipples, making waves of anguished desire wash through her being. Weakened by the unaccustomed feelings that his ardour aroused in her, she was unable to move as his hand stealthily sought the hem of her gown, and his blazing touch traced tendrils of sensation up the length of her slender thigh.
"Ah, mi amor," he groaned. "So lovely, so pure. You drive me mad with desire, mi amor. I have wanted you since I first saw you, so proud and cold on the deck of your father's ship. But not so cold now, my dear, eh?"
In fact, Valdez's kisses were wreaking havoc on Tessa's feelings. How? How could she be feeling such things for this man who had cold-bloodedly sunk her father's ship and murdered 100 men with his own hands? She should be recoiling in horror, but instead she found herself gasping for breath, opening her mouth to receive his burning kisses, arching her body in involuntary abandon beneath the demanding pressure of his burgeoning manhood.
"Ah, mi amor," he gasped. I cannot wait, but I do not wish to hurt you. Gently, mi amor, gently.
Tessa gasped as she felt the increasing pressure of his desire making its presence known between her legs.
Oh, she said. Oh, please, you can't. I don't want you to.
Fine time to start making protests, I thought.
Don't worry, mi amor. Trust me.
Gradually, little by little, she relaxed under the touch of his hypnotic caresses, feeling the warmth in her stomach grow and spread. His lips brushed her breast, and his hot breath, murmuring reassurances, took away all her resistance. As she relaxed, her thighs opened without her willing it. Moving with infinite slowness, his engorged shaft teased aside the membrane of her innocence. I let out a whoop and lost my grasp on the book, which slid off my lap and fell on the floor with a plop near Dr. Abernathy's feet. Excuse me, I murmured, and bent to retrieve it, my face flaming. As I came up with the impetuous pirate in my sweaty grasp, though, I saw that far from preserving his usual austere mien, Dr. Abernathy was grinning widely.
Let me guess, he said. Valdez just teased aside the membrane of her innocence.
Yes, I said, breaking out into helpless giggling again. How did you know?
Well, you weren't too far into it, he said, taking the book from my hand.
His short, blunt fingers flicked the pages expertly.
It had to be that one, or maybe the one on page 73, where he laves her pink mounds with his hungry tongue.
He what?
See for yourself.
He thrust the book back into my hands, pointing to a spot halfway down the page.
Sure enough.
Lifting aside the coverlet, he bent his coal-black head and laved her pink mounds with his hungry tongue. Tessa moaned and... I gave an unhinged shriek.
You've actually read this?
I demanded, tearing my eyes away from Tessa and Valdez.
Oh, yeah, he said,
the grin widening. He had a gold tooth far back on the right side.
Two or three times. It's not the best one, but it isn't bad.
The best one? There are more like this.
Sure. Let's see.
He rose and began digging through the pile of tattered paperbacks on the table.
You want to look for the ones with no covers, he explained. Those are the best.
And here I thought you never read anything but Lancet and the Journal of the AMA, I said.
What? I spend 36 hours up to my elbows in people's guts, and I want to come up here and read Advances in Gallbladder Resection? Hell no. I'd rather sail the Spanish Main with Valdez.
He eyed me with some interest, the grin still not quite gone.
I didn't think you read anything but the New England Journal of Medicine either, Lady Jane, he said. Appearances are deceiving, huh?
Must be, I said dryly. What's this... Lady Jane.
Oh, Hochstein started that one, he said,
leaning back with his fingers linked around one knee.
It's the voice, that accent that sounds like you just drank tea with the Queen. That's what you've got, keeps the guys from being worse than they are. See, you sound like Winston Churchill, if Winston Churchill was a lady, that is, and that scares them a little. You've got something else, though.
He viewed me thoughtfully, rocking back in his chair.
You have a way of talking like you expect to get your way, and if you don't, you'll know the reason why. Where'd you learn that?
In the war, I said, smiling at his description. His eyebrows went up.
Korea?
No. I was a combat nurse during the Second World War in France. I saw a lot of head matrons who could turn interns and orderlies to jelly with a glance. And later... I had a good deal of practice where that air of inviolate authority, assumed though it might be, had stood me in good stead against people with a great deal more power than the nursing staff and interns of Boston General Hospital. He nodded, absorbed in my explanation.
Yeah, that makes sense. I used Walter Cronkite myself.
Walter Cronkite? I goggled at him. He grinned again, showing his gold tooth.
You can think of somebody better.
Besides, I got to hear him for free on the radio or the TV every night. I used to entertain my mama. She wanted me to be a preacher.
He smiled, half ruefully.
If I talked like Walter Cronkite where we lived in those days, I wouldn't have lived to go to med school.
I was liking Joe Abernethy more by the second. I hope your mother wasn't disappointed that you became a doctor instead of a preacher.
Tell you the truth, I'm not sure, he said, still grinning. When I told her, she stared at me for a minute, then heaved a big sigh and said, "Well, at least you can get my rheumatism medicine for me cheap."
I laughed wryly.
I didn't get that much enthusiasm when I told my husband I was going to be a doctor. He stared at me and finally said, if I was bored, why didn't I volunteer to write letters for the inmates of the nursing home?
Joe's eyes were a soft golden brown, like toffee drops. There was a glint of humour in them as they fixed on me.
Yeah, folks still think it's fine to say to your face that you can't be doing what you're doing. Why are you here, little lady, and not home minding your man and child? He mimicked.
He grinned wryly and patted my hand.
Don't worry, they'll give it up sooner or later. They mostly don't ask me to my face any more why I ain't cleaning the toilets like God made me to.
Then the nurse had come with word that my appendix was awake, and I had left. But the friendship begun on page 42 had flourished, and Joe Abernethy had become one of my best friends, possibly the only person close to me who truly understood what I did and why. I smiled a little, feeling the slickness of the embossing on the cover. Then I leaned forward and put the book back into the seat pocket. Perhaps I didn't want to escape just now. Outside, a floor of moonlit cloud cut us off from the earth below. Up here, everything was silent, beautiful and serene, in marked contrast to the turmoil of life below. I had the odd feeling of being suspended, motionless, cocooned in solitude, even the heavy breathing of the woman next to me only a part of the white noise that makes up silence. One with the tepid rush of the air conditioning and the shuffle of the stewardess's shoes along the carpet. At the same time, I knew we were rushing on inexorably through the air, propelled at hundreds of miles per hour to some end. As for it being a safe one, we could only hope. I closed my eyes in suspended animation. Back in Scotland, Roger and Bree were hunting Jamie. Ahead, in Boston, my job and Joe were waiting. And Jamie himself? I tried to push the thought away, determined not to think of him until the decision was made. I felt a slight ruffling of my hair and one lock brushed against my cheek, light as a lover's touch. But surely it was no more than the rush of air from the vent overhead, and my imagination that the stale smells of perfume and cigarettes were suddenly underlaid by the scents of wool and heather. Chapter 19. To Lay a Ghost. Home at last, to the house on Fury Street, where I had lived with Frank and Brianna for nearly 20 years. The azaleas by the door were not quite dead, but their leaves hung in limp, shabby clusters, a thick layer of fallen leaves curling on the dry-baked bed underneath. It was a hot summer. There wasn't any other kind in Boston, and the August rains hadn't come, even though it was mid-September by now. I set my bags by the front door and went to turn on the hose. It had been lying in the sun. The green rubber snake was hot enough to burn my hand, and I shifted it uneasily from palm to palm until the rumble of water brought it suddenly alive and cooled it with a burst of spray. I didn't like azaleas all that much to start with. I would have pulled them out long since, but I had been reluctant to alter any detail of the house after Frank's death, for Brianna's sake. Enough of a shock, I thought, to begin university and have your father die in 1 year without more changes. I had been ignoring the house for a long time. I could go on doing so. All right, I said crossly to the azaleas as I turned off the hose.
I hope you're happy, because that's all you get. I want to have a drink myself.
And a bath, I added, seeing their mud-spattered leaves.
I sat on the edge of the big sunken tub in my dressing gown, watching the water thunder in, churning the bubble bath into clouds of perfumed sea foam. Steam rose from the boiling surface. The water would be almost too hot. I turned it off, one quick, neat twist of the tap, and sat for a moment, the house around me still, save for the crackle of popping bath bubbles, faint as the sounds of a far-off battle. I realized perfectly well what I was doing. I had been doing it ever since I stepped aboard the Flying Scotsman in Inverness and felt the thrum of the track come alive beneath my feet. I was testing myself. I had been taking careful note of the machines, all the contrivances of modern daily life, and, more important, of my own response to them. The train to Edinburgh, the plane to Boston, the taxicab from the airport, and all the dozens of tiny mechanical flourishes attending, vending machines, street lights, the plane's mile-high lavatory with its swirl of nasty blue-green disinfectant, whisking waste and germs away with a push of a button. Restaurants, with their tidy certificates from the Department of Health, guaranteeing at least a better-than-even chance of escaping food poisoning when eating therein. Inside my own house, the omnipresent buttons that supplied light and heat and water and cooked food. The question was, did I care? I dipped a hand into the steaming bathwater and swirled it to and fro, watching the shadows of the vortex dancing in the marble depths. Could I live without all the conveniences, large and small, to which I was accustomed? I had been asking myself that with each touch of a button, each rumble of a motor, and was quite sure that the answer was yes. Time didn't make all the difference, after all. I could walk across the city and find people who lived without many of these conveniences. Farther abroad, and there were entire countries where people lived in reasonable content and complete ignorance of electricity. For myself, I had never cared a lot. I had lived with my Uncle Lamb, an eminent archaeologist, since my own parents' death when I was 5. Consequently, I had grown up in conditions that could conservatively be called primitive, as I accompanied him on all his field expeditions. Yes, hot baths and light bulbs were nice, but I had lived without them during several periods of my life, during the war, for instance, and never found the lack of them acute. The water had cooled enough to be tolerable. I dropped the dressing gown on the floor and stepped in, feeling a pleasant shiver as the heat at my feet made my shoulders prickle in cool contrast. I subsided into the tub and relaxed, stretching my legs. 18th-century hip baths were barely more than large barrels. One normally bathed in segments, immersing the centre of the body first, with the legs hanging outside, then stood up and rinsed the upper torso while soaking the feet. More frequently, one bathed from a pitcher and basin with the aid of a cloth. No, conveniences and comforts were merely that. Nothing essential. Nothing I couldn't do without. Not that conveniences were the only issue, by a long chalk. The past was a dangerous country. But even the advances of so-called civilization were no guarantee of safety. I had lived through 2 major modern wars, actually served on the battlefields of one of them, and could see another taking shape on the telly every evening. Civilized warfare was, if anything, more horrifying than its older versions. Daily life might be safer, but only if one chose one's walk in it with care. Parts of Roxbury now were as dangerous as any alley I had walked in the Paris of 200 years past. I sighed and pulled up the plug with my toes. No use speculating about impersonal things like bathtubs, bombs, and rapists. Indoor plumbing was no more than a minor distraction. The real issue was the people involved, and always had been. Me and Brianna and Jamie.
The last of the water gurgled away. I stood up, feeling slightly light-headed, and wiped away the last of the bubbles. The big mirror was misted with steam, but clear enough to show me myself from the knees upward, pink as a boiled shrimp. Dropping the towel, I looked myself over, flexed my arms, raised them overhead, checking for bagginess. None. Biceps and triceps all nicely defined, deltoids neatly rounded and sloping into the high curve of the pectoralis major. I turned slightly to one side, tensing and relaxing my abdominals. Obliques in decent tone, the rectus abdominis flattening almost to concavity.
"Good thing the family doesn't run to fat," I murmured.
Uncle Lamb had remained trim and taut to the day of his death at 75. I supposed my father, Uncle Lamb's brother, had been constructed similarly, and wondered suddenly what my mother's backside had looked like. Women, after all, had a certain amount of excess adipose tissue to contend with. I turned all the way round and peered back over my shoulder at the mirror. The long columnar muscles of my back gleamed wetly as I twisted. I still had a waist, and a good narrow one, too. As for my own backside... "Well, no dimples, anyway," I said aloud. I turned around and stared at my reflection. "It could be a lot worse," I said to it. Feeling somewhat heartened, I put on my nightgown and went about the business of putting the house to bed. No cats to put out, no dogs to feed. Bozo, the last of our dogs, had died of old age the year before, and I hadn't wanted to get another, with Brianna off at school and my own hours at the hospital long and irregular. Adjust the thermostat, check the locks of windows and doors, see that the burners of the stove were off. That was all there was to it. For 18 years, the nightly route had included a stop in Brianna's room, but not since she had left for university. Moved by a mixture of habit and compulsion, I pushed open the door to her room and clicked on the light. Some people have the knack of objects, and others haven't. Bree had it. Scarcely an inch of wall space showed between the posters, photographs, dried flowers, scraps of tie-dyed fabric, framed certificates, and other impedimenta on the walls. Some people have a way of arranging everything about them, so the objects take on not only their own meaning and a relation to the other things displayed with them, but something more besides, an indefinable aura that belongs as much to their invisible owner as to the objects themselves. "I am here because Brianna placed me here," the things in the room seem to say. "I am here because she is who she is." It was odd that she should have that, really, I thought. Frank had had it. When I had gone to empty his university office after his death, I had thought it like the fossilized cast of some extinct animal. Books and papers and bits of rubbish, holding exactly the shape and texture and vanished weight of the mind that had inhabited the space. For some of Brianna's objects, the relation to her was obvious. Pictures of me, of Frank, of Bozo, of friends. The scraps of fabric were ones she had made, her chosen patterns, the colours she liked. A brilliant turquoise, deep indigo, magenta, and clear yellow. But other things. Why should the scatter of dried freshwater snail shells on the bureau say to me, "Brianna"? Why that one lump of rounded pumice taken from the beach at Truro, indistinguishable from 100,000 others, except for the fact that she had taken it? I didn't have a way with objects. I had no impulse either to acquire or to decorate. Frank had often complained of the Spartan furnishings at home until Brianna grew old enough to take a hand. Whether it was the fault of my nomadic upbringing, or only the way I was, I lived mostly inside my skin, with no impulse to alter my surroundings to reflect me. Jamie was the same. He had had the few small objects, always carried in his sporran for utility or as talismans, and beyond that had neither owned nor cared for things. even during the short period when we had lived luxuriously in Paris, and the longer time of tranquillity at Lallybroch, he had never shown any disposition to acquire objects. For him as well, it might have been the circumstances of his early manhood, when he had lived like a hunted animal, never owning anything beyond the weapons he depended on for survival. But perhaps it was natural to him also, this isolation from the world of things, this sense of self-sufficiency, one of the things that had made us seek completion in each other. Odd all the same, that Brianna should have so much resembled both her fathers, in their very different ways. I said a silent good night to the ghost of my absent daughter, and put out the light. The thought of Frank went with me into the bedroom. The sight of the big double bed, smooth and untroubled under its dark blue satin spread, brought him suddenly and vividly to mind, in a way I hadn't thought of him in many months. I supposed it was the possibility of impending departure that made me think of him now. This room, this bed, in fact, was where I had said goodbye to him for the last time.
"Can't you come to bed, Claire? It's past midnight."
Frank looked up at me over the edge of his book. He was already in bed himself, reading with the book propped open upon his knees. The soft pool of light from the lamp made him look as though he were floating in a warm bubble, serenely isolated from the dark chilliness of the rest of the room. It was early January, and despite the furnace's best efforts, the only truly warm place at night was bed, under heavy blankets. I smiled at him and rose from my chair, dropping the heavy wool dressing gown from my shoulders. "Am I keeping you up? Sorry. Just reliving this morning's surgery."
"Yes, I know," he said dryly. "I can tell by looking at you. Your eyes glaze over and your mouth hangs open."
"Sorry," I said again, matching his tone.
"I can't be responsible for what my face is doing when I'm thinking." "What good does thinking do?" he asked, sticking a bookmark in his book. "You've done whatever you could. Worrying about it now won't change." "Oh, well."
He shrugged irritably and closed the book.
"I've said it all before."
"You have," I said shortly. I got into bed, shivering slightly, and tucked my gown down round my legs. Frank scooted automatically in my direction, and I slid down under the sheets beside him, huddling together to pool our warmth against the cold. "Oh, wait! I've got to move the phone." I flung back the covers and scrambled out again to move the phone from Frank's side of the bed to mine. He liked to sit in bed in the early evening, chatting with students and colleagues while I read or made surgical notes beside him, but he resented being wakened by the late calls that came from the hospital for me. Resented it enough that I had arranged for the hospital to call only for absolute emergencies, or when I left instructions to keep me informed of a specific patient's progress. Tonight, I had left instructions. It was a tricky bowel resection. If things went wrong, I might have to go back in a hurry. Frank grunted as I turned out the light and slipped into bed again. But after a moment, he rolled toward me, throwing an arm across my middle. I rolled onto my side and curled against him, gradually relaxing as my chilled toes thawed. I mentally replayed the details of the operation, feeling again the chill at my feet from the refrigeration in the operating room, and the initial unsettling feeling of the warmth in the patient's belly as my gloved fingers slid inside. The diseased bowel itself, coiled like a viper, patterned with the purple splotches of ecchymosis and the slow leakage of bright blood from tiny ruptures.
"I'd been thinking."
Frank's voice came out of the darkness behind me, excessively casual. I was still absorbed in the vision of the surgery, but struggled to pull myself back to the present. "About what?"
"My sabbatical."
His leave from the university was due to start in a month. He had planned to make a series of short trips through the northeastern United States, gathering material, then go to England for 6 months, returning to Boston to spend the last 3 months of the sabbatical writing.
"I'd thought of going to England straight off," he said carefully.
"Well, why not? The weather will be dreadful, but if you're going to spend most of the time in libraries..."
"I want to take Brianna with me."
I stopped dead, the cold in the room suddenly coalescing into a small lump of suspicion in the pit of my stomach. "She can't go now. She's only a semester from graduation. Surely you could wait until we can join you in the summer. I've put in for a long vacation then, and perhaps..."
"I'm going now. For good. Without you."
I pulled away and sat up, turning on the light. Frank lay blinking up at me, dark hair dishevelled. It had gone grey at the temples, giving him a distinguished air that seemed to have alarming effects on the more susceptible of his female students. I felt quite astonishingly composed.
"Why now, all of a sudden? The latest one putting pressure on you, is she?"
The look of alarm that flashed into his eyes was so pronounced as to be comical. I laughed with a noticeable lack of humour.
"You actually thought I didn't know? God, Frank, you are the most oblivious man."
He sat up in bed, jaw tight.
"I thought I'd been most discreet."
"You may have been at that," I said sardonically. "I counted 6 over the last 10 years. If there were really a dozen or so, then you were quite the model of discretion." His face seldom showed great emotion, but a whitening beside his mouth told me that he was very angry indeed.
"This one must be something special," I said, folding my arms and leaning back against the headboard in assumed casualness. "But still, why the rush to go to England now? And why take Bree?"
"She can go to boarding school for her last term," he said shortly. "Be a new experience for her."
"Not one I expect she wants," I said. "She won't want to leave her friends, especially not just before graduation. And certainly not to go to an English boarding school."
I shuddered at the thought. I had come within inches of being immured in just such a school as a child. The scent of the hospital cafeteria sometimes evoked memories of it, complete with the waves of terrified helplessness I had felt when Uncle Lamb had taken me to visit the place.
"A little discipline never hurt anyone," Frank said.
He had recovered his temper, but the lines of his face were still tight.
"Might have done you some good."
He waved a hand, dismissing the topic.
"Let that be. Still, I've decided to go back to England permanently. I've a good position offered at Cambridge, and I mean to take it up. You won't leave the hospital, of course. But I don't mean to leave my daughter behind."
"Your daughter?"
I felt momentarily incapable of speech. So, he had a new job all set, and a new mistress to go along. He'd been planning this for some time then. A whole new life, but not with Brianna.
"My daughter," he said calmly. "You can come to visit whenever you like, of course."
"You bloody bastard," I said.
"Do be reasonable, Claire."
He looked down his nose, giving me treatment A. Long-suffering patience, reserved for students appealing failing grades.
"You're scarcely ever home. If I'm gone, there will be no one to look after Bree properly."
"You talk as though she's 8, not almost 18. For heaven's sake, she's nearly grown."
"All the more reason she needs care and supervision," he snapped. "If you'd seen what I'd seen at the university, the drinking, the drugging, the..."
"I do see it," I said through my teeth. "At fairly close range in the emergency room, Bree is not likely to..."
"She damn well is. Girls have no sense at that age. She'll be off with the first fellow who..."
"Don't be idiotic. Bree's very sensible. Besides, all young people experiment. That's how they learn. You can't keep her swaddled in cotton wool all her life."
"Better swaddle than fucking a black man," he shot back.
A mottled red showed faintly over his cheekbones.
"Like mother, like daughter, eh? But that's not how it's going to be, damn it. Not if I've anything to say about it."
I heaved out of bed and stood up, glaring down at him.
"You," I said,
have not got one bloody, filthy, stinking thing to say about Bree or anything else. I was trembling with rage and had to press my fists into the sides of my legs to keep from striking him. You have the absolute unmitigated gall to tell me that you're leaving me to live with the latest of a succession of mistresses, and then imply that I have been having an affair with Joe Abernathy. That's what you mean, isn't it? He had the grace to lower his eyes slightly.
Everyone thinks you have, he muttered. You spend all your time with a man. It's the same thing, so far as Bree is concerned. Dragging her into situations where she's exposed to danger and to those sorts of people.
Black people, I suppose you mean?
I damn well do,
he said, looking up at me with eyes flashing.
It's bad enough to have the Abernathys to parties all the time, though at least he's educated. But that obese person I met at their house with the tribal tattoos and the mud in his hair, that repulsive lounge lizard with the oily voice, and young Abernathys taken to hanging around Bree day and night, taking her to marches and rallies and orgies in low dives.
I shouldn't think there are any high dives, I said, repressing an inappropriate urge to laugh at Frank's unkind but accurate assessment of two of Leonard Abernathy's more outre friends. Did you know Lenny's taken to calling himself Muhammad Ishmael Shabazz now?
Yes, he told me, he said shortly, and I'm taking no risk of having my daughter become Mrs. Shabazz.
I don't think Bree feels that way about Lenny, I assured him, struggling to suppress my irritation.
She isn't going to either. She's going to England with me.
Not if she doesn't want to, I said, with great finality. No doubt feeling that his position put him at a disadvantage, Frank climbed out of bed and began groping for his slippers.
I don't need your permission to take my daughter to England, he said. And Bree's still a minor. She'll go wherever I say. I'd appreciate it if you'd find her medical records. The new school will need them.
Your daughter, I said again. I vaguely noticed the chill in the room, but was so angry that I felt hot all over. Bree's my daughter, and you'll take her bloody nowhere.
You can't stop me,
he pointed out with aggravating calmness, picking up his dressing gown from the foot of the bed.
The hell I can't, I said.
You want to divorce me? Fine. Use any grounds you like, with the exception of adultery, which you can't prove because it doesn't exist. But if you try to take Bree away with you, I'll have a thing or two to say about adultery. Do you want to know how many of your discarded mistresses have come to see me, to ask me to give you up? His mouth hung open in shock. I told them all that I'd give you up in a minute, I said, if you asked. I folded my arms, tucking my hands into my armpits. I was beginning to feel the chilliness again. I did wonder why you never asked, but I supposed it was because of Brianna. His face had gone quite bloodless now, and showed white as a skull in the dimness on the other side of the bed.
Well, he said,
with a poor attempt at his usual self-possession,
I shouldn't have thought you minded. It's not as though you ever made a move to stop me.
I stared at him, completely taken aback. Stop you? I said. What should I have done? Steamed open your mail and waved the letters under your nose? Made a scene at the faculty Christmas party? Complained to the dean? His lips pressed tight together for a moment, then relaxed.
You might have behaved as though it mattered to you,
he said quietly.
It mattered.
My voice sounded strangled. He shook his head, still staring at me, his eyes dark in the lamplight.
Not enough.
He paused, face floating pale in the air above his dark dressing gown, then came round the bed to stand by me.
Sometimes I wondered if I could rightfully blame you,
he said, almost thoughtfully.
He looked like Bree, didn't he? He was like her.
Yes. He breathed heavily, almost a snort.
I could see it in your face when you'd look at her.
I could see you thinking of him.
Damn you, Claire Beecham, he said very softly.
Damn you and your face that can't hide a thing you think or feel.
There was a silence after this, of the sort that makes you hear all the tiny, unhearable noises of creaking wood and breathing houses, only in an effort to pretend you haven't heard what was just said.
I did love you, I said softly at last. Once.
Once, he echoed. Should I be grateful for that?
The feeling was beginning to come back to my numb lips.
I did tell you, I said. And then, when you wouldn't go.
Frank, I did try. Whatever he heard in my voice stopped him for a moment.
I did, I said, very softly.
He turned away and moved toward my dressing table, where he touched things restlessly, picking them up and putting them down at random.
I couldn't leave you at the first, pregnant, alone. Only a cad would have done that. And then, Bree.
He stared sightlessly at the lipstick he held in one hand, then set it gently back on the glassy tabletop.
I couldn't give her up, he said softly.
He turned to look at me, eyes dark holes in a shadowed face.
Did you know I couldn't sire a child? I had myself tested a few years ago. I'm sterile. Did you know?
I shook my head, not trusting myself to speak.
Bree is mine, my daughter, he said, as though to himself. The only child I'll ever have. I couldn't give her up.
He gave a short laugh.
I couldn't give her up, but you couldn't see her without thinking of him, could you? Without that constant memory, I wonder, would you have forgotten him in time?
No. The whispered words seemed to go through him like an electric shock. He stood frozen for a moment, then whirled to the closet and began to jerk on his clothes over his pyjamas. I stood, arms wrapped around my body, watching as he pulled on his overcoat and stamped out of the room, not looking at me. The collar of his blue silk pyjamas stuck up over the astrakhan trim of his coat. A moment later, I heard the closing of the front door. He had sufficient presence of mind not to slam it. And then the sound of a cold motor turning reluctantly over. The headlights swept across the bedroom ceiling as the car backed down the drive, and then were gone, leaving me shaking by the rumpled bed.
This ends Disc 9. Voyager, Disc 10.
Frank didn't come back. I tried to sleep, but found myself lying rigid in the cold bed, mentally reliving the argument, listening for the crunch of his tires in the drive. At last, I got up and dressed, left a note for Bree, and went out myself. The hospital hadn't called, but I might as well go and have a look at my patient. It was better than tossing and turning all night. And to be honest, I wouldn't have minded had Frank come home to find me gone. The streets were slick as butter, black ice gleaming in the streetlights. The yellow phosphor glow lit walls of falling snow. Within an hour, the ice that lined the streets would be concealed beneath fresh powder and twice as perilous to travel. The only consolation was that there was no one on the streets at 4 a.m. to be imperiled. No one but me, that is. Inside the hospital, the usual warm, stuffy, institutional smell wrapped itself round me like a blanket of familiarity, shutting out the snow-filled black night outside. "He's okay," the nurse said to me softly, as though a raised voice might disturb the sleeping man. "All the vitals are stable and the count's okay. No bleeding." I could see that it was true. The patient's face was pale, but with a faint undertone of pink, like the veining in a white rose petal, and the pulse in the hollow of his throat was strong and regular. I let out the deep breath I hadn't realized I was holding.
That's good, I said. Very good.
The nurse smiled warmly at me, and I had to resist the impulse to lean against him and dissolve.